Thank you all very much for coming. We're going to talk today about Hubert Harrison. We're going to focus on this book, Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918. It's volume one of a two-volume biography on Hubert Harrison. It's the first multi-volume biography of an Afro-Caribbean and only the fifth of an African-American, after those of Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, Langston Hughes, and Martin Luther King Jr. He is a giant of black history, of American history, of radical history. The book was published by Columbia University Press. It has 600 and some odd pages, volume one, 116 pages of notes, I think almost 60 photos with detailed captions. It's 20 plus years in the making. It's serious scholarship on an incredibly important person. We'll be focusing on that. We also have a reader on Hubert Harrison, which is 138 of his over 700 articles that he wrote in the course of his lifetime. He dies young at 44, at age 44 in 1927. This is, as I said, 138 of his articles. We're going to put all 700 plus online for free at Columbia University, permanent searchable database forever, worldwide. Father of Harlem Radicalism. I'm at work on that progress now. There is no money involved. This is to get him out and make it available.
Thank you.
So we've got that. And I will be making reference in the course of my talk to the work of Theodore W. Allen, who we spoke about last time. We have outside, at cost, his two-volume, the new expanded edition, Biverso Books, of The Invention of the White Race, major work. I believe of any European-American writer that I'm familiar with, Allen offers the most in terms of analyzing race and class in this country. The new edition, I have expanded indexes in the back, introductions, new end matter, and I want to call to your attention. Also, we have this pamphlet, which is a little précis. Allen wrote in 1975 of the work he was developing, which grew into this. This is his life's work, his magnum opus. And this is freely available on my webpage. My webpage is simply my name, jeffreybperry.net. That's it. And if you go there, you'll find all kinds of free information on Harrison and Allen, audio, video, written by them, written about them. And I want to, in particular, call your attention on my homepage of my webpage, top left, to an article entitled The Developing Conjuncture and Some Insights from Hubert Harrison and Theodore W. Allen on the Centrality of the Fight Against White Supremacy. Because I've written so much about Harrison, I focus in that article a lot on Allen. And that article was published first in Cultural Logic. Joe Ramsey, who's here in the back, was the editor of that issue, right? And I open up, and it has some epigraph with some quotes from Harrison and Allen that tell a story. Then I move into a brief intro on both people. Then I go through some statistics. And in those statistics, I basically try to show how class and white supremacy are shaping this country. And I go through, I mean, as we know, the gap between rich and poor is at record proportions. And you go through statistic after statistic, and working people are getting crushed. Then every issue you look at is shaped in a white supremacist fashion, be it the unemployment rate, 2-to-1, or everything. So I lay out some core statistics, but I also show some international statistics, because I want to emphasize one of the arguments when you're dealing with the struggle against white supremacy is white workers benefit from this system. Now, so I show international comparison. We're the richest country in the world, and we're 47th in health care. You look at the social safety net, maternity leave, paternity leave, life satisfaction, et cetera, et cetera. We're getting crushed compared to other capitalist countries, right? So it's important for people to understand that, you know, have a perspective on this whole thing. And I come out of a background, as was mentioned, I 33 years in the labor movement, worked in a big bulk mail center in Jersey City for many years. So I'm very clear on this, but you go around sometimes in these universities, you hear all this other stuff. Not everybody benefiting so much. So that's where we go with Harrison and Allen. Just one second. Now, I also want to call your attention on my webpage before we start getting into this slide presentation. I recently did, back in October, an article on Harrison's grandson. His name is Ray Richardson. Ray Richardson was the producer of a show on WGBH, Boston's flagship public television station, and the show is called Say Brother, right? And he becomes producer in 1968 at age 23. It's a black hour-long TV show, really geared towards the African-American community, and it mixes politics and entertainment and the arts, and it has an extraordinary group of young people involved in that show. Amongst others, we had yesterday Sarah Ann Shaw. We spoke at the Dudley Public Library. Sarah Ann Shaw, Stan Lathan, who people may know from his later work on some of the children's programming on national TV, but he's also the father of Sanai Lathan, an actress people may be familiar with today. And Jewel Gomez, who was one of the first people in California to get married under the new law, gay marriage thing. She went and moved to California and did major work. A woman named Hazel Bright, who's been affiliated with Roxbury Community College. A lot of people you would know. And just to make the story short, first I recommend particularly younger generation read this, because this is how young activists in Boston really impacted the political scene here. But what happens briefly that I particularly focused on, as people know, last year, Malcolm X's grandson dies in Mexico under somewhat suspicious circumstances. And that jogged my memory, because Malcolm is the major black radical in Harlem in the latter half of the 20th century, Harrison in the earlier half, right? The father of Harlem radicalism, as we'll see. And his grandson, Ray Richardson, died in Mexico under suspicious circumstances, too. So let me give a little more on the story. So what happened in 1970, in the summer of 1970, New Bedford, Mass. Erupts in a rebellion, right? And WGBO, under Ray Richardson's direction, his producing and direction, take the TV cameras into New Bedford for 6 days. And they give a voice to the African American. They let the people speak about their. This is not your normal TV, with that other stuff. And GBH didn't know what to do. This is beyond the limits, right? So what they do in response, particularly the corporate pressure comes in there for some of their funding, and they take the show off the air, and they fire Ray Richardson. So then there's a series, just before the time to many of the people, when I was speaking earlier at the church, some of the people were familiar with this history. It's a little younger crowd. So there's all kinds of community protests, and people you're familiar with, Mel King, Chuck Turner was at the event yesterday, people who've been around for a long time waging struggle up here. They lead community protests, the staff protests, and they eventually force the station to bring the show back, right? They won't bring Ray Richardson back. He's still, as we used to say, when you're fired or suspended, he's out in the street still. So he's out in the street. So what happens is Ray Richardson and his fiancée/wife, it's not clear what their status was, a woman named Vashti Lowndes, who's a Howard University graduate. Mary Baraka recently died. She had been very close to Mary Baraka before that. If you read in his autobiography, you'll read about her. And she had won, while in her 20s, an Emmy, I guess is the award, for her work with Like It Is, which is Gil Noble's show in New York, very comparable to Say Brother up here. So these are two extremely talented people. And when I write the article about Say Brother and Ray Richardson, I talk about the collective spirit of work. I mean, it's really exemplary what these people did. And they are down in Mexico visiting Ray's father. His father is a Tuskegee Airman, right? He had gone during World War II, he's actually an actor before that with the early theater groups, included Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis and some of the black theater groups starting in the 30s. An extraordinary talented family. He came back, and after a number of very vicious white supremacist incidents in the U.S., he says, I'm not even dealing with this anymore, and he goes down to Mexico to live. So after they're visiting him for a month and a half or so, they decide to come back, and they go for one last swim. There's more to the story, but it's in there, and I have lots of links. If you go to you'll also find video clips from Say Brother. So you'll see Muhammad Ali speaking against the Vietnam War, the stuff that they were putting on the air all the time, debates on the arts. You'll see early Curtis Mayfield, just stuff that you might enjoy, see some of these old-time people on these Boston shows. As they're getting ready to leave, they go swimming. Ray and Vashti are both very strong swimmers, and according to the reports in the Boston Globe and elsewhere, they die swimming. Now, this is the period when George Jackson, Fred Hampton, Mark Clark, Whitney Young, after he comes out against the war in Africa, dies from drowning, right? All these black leaders are getting killed, as well as we had Malcolm and Martin beforehand. Also, it's the period of the coup in Chile against Allende, and people being assassinated by U.S., you know, people in Latin America, U.S. CIA type people. But as I'm looking in the Boston Globe on the obituary of Ray Richardson, right underneath his obituary, this is in January 1971, is one of Jacobo Arbenz. Jacobo Arbenz was the president of Guatemala, duly elected, left-leaning, who challenged United Fruit and U.S. interests and stuff, and was ousted in an open CIA coup, which they talked about and bragged about back then, and they still brag about. He had left Guatemala, gone to Cuba for a while, was living in Mexico. On virtually the same day that Ray Richardson and Vashti Lowndes die from drowning in Mexico, Jacobo Arbenz is reported as dead from drowning in Mexico also. What makes his case particularly suspicious is he's supposedly dead from drowning in his own bathtub, right? So I wrote this article. Part of the reason I wrote the article is I'm looking for younger people, you know, with a little interest in, particularly younger people, anyone, you know, probe some of these FOIA requests and stuff like this and dig deeper, because I think there is much more there, and we know the U.S.'s role in there. As we know today, their willingness to go abroad and kill U.S. citizens or not, whomever they think they are.
The bathtub works. Yeah. The American reporter that killed found the bathtub. They say it was suicide. It wasn't.
So that's a little background. Just one more Boston link before we get into our slideshow, which we're going to put up here anyway. Is there Harrison, we're going to end in 1918 today, but Hubert Harrison also comes to Boston in 1924. He speaks at the Ford Hall Forum. He speaks, he edits a series of articles from January to June in the Boston Chronicle, which, if you don't know, it was a black weekly, and Harrison writes, it's some of his best journalism. A number of those articles can be found in the Hubert Harrison Reader, and they're going to be discussed in detail in Volume 2. But Boston, in many ways, is very central to a lot of work, and when he and J.A. Rogers, the great lay historian, they do a tour up to Boston in June of 1924 to announce the launching of his organization, the International Colored Unity League. That's his last major effort. Now, many people, well, some people anyway, because Harrison still doesn't have all the attention he wants, but Kamosi Woodard is a historian at Sarah Lawrence College, and he writes on the back of the biography, drawing comparisons between Malcolm and Harrison. And one of the things about Malcolm is his last organization, for those who are familiar with it, is the Organization of Afro-American Unity, more broadly unitary. Harrison's last organization is the International Colored Unity League, a similar, more broadly unitary thing. And he comes up here to really kind of announce the program and everything like that. So that's very important, all of that. Now, the people who hosted Harrison for one of his major talks were the League of Women for Community Service, which are still listed in your directories up here in Boston. Sarah Ann Shaw has some association with them. And when I came up to Boston years ago and went to the public library and, you know, trying to locate copies of this Boston Chronicle, all they could say was there might be a set with the League of Women for Community Service, and then someone else, you know, one of the old directories said, oh, maybe out in San Diego, somebody else in Hartford. I've tried all these things. We've not come up with it, but I'm alerting you all to keep your antennas up. Maybe there'll be a lead or a link to this League of Women. The League is here, but issues of the Boston Chronicle. Now we're going to get on with Hubert Harrison's story. Volume 1, we're going to show, it's going to take a little over an hour. I'm going to try and keep you interested. We're going to have a lot of slides. Don't get lost on the wording. I'll try and get you to the essence sometimes on the slides. If you want to take a break, and we don't have coffee here, so just stretch a little, we'll do it. Okay. This is Hubert Harrison. That's the cover of the book, which I showed you. There's the other book. There's Alan. Harrison lives 1883 to 1927, dies at 24. The first volume goes up to 1918. Allen's two volumes. They are both autodidacts. They're anti-white supremacist working-class intellectuals. I believe Hubert Harrison and Theodore W. Allen are two of the very most important thinkers on race and class in 20th century America. They work far outside the academy. They are self-educated, as was Malcolm later. This is a quote from a fellow named George W. Stocking, who writes on, I'm going to just read it to you quickly. standing outside the normal process by which intellectual traditions are transmitted, the autodidact may embody the spirit of his age in an unusually direct way. Sometimes they see more clearly. They're not, you know, get all their mind eaten up in those academies and those universities and all the hoops you have to jump through, you know, in that process. I can explain in terms of my own work, you know, with my work on Harrison. Here's my webpage, simply my name, all kinds of free information. In particular, I call you to that article again in the issue of, it's also on the Cultural Logic webpage, but I like to bring people to my webpage so they look at other things too. But Cultural Logic is cited right there, and that's it. And that's, again, the issue that Joe edited. Here's a picture of Ray Richardson, right, who I just mentioned. Here's the crew of Say Brother, Ray Richardson, Stan Lathan, Sarah Ann Shaw, Hazel Bright, Jewel Gomez, some of the people I mentioned. Extraordinary work. You want to learn about them. This article appeared in Black Agenda Report, Black Commentator, and Black Star News. And they have different photos in each, but easily found if you Google my name and Ray Richardson's. I co-authored it with Ray's brother and Harrison's other grandson, Charles Richardson. That's Vashti, who also dies with him, right? All right, there's the Boston Chronicle. Okay, Harrison, here we go. Hubert Harrison, race and class conscious radical internationalist. First, I'm going to talk about Harrison as an intellectual. Then I'm going to talk about Harrison as a radical. Then we're going to get into a little of his life story. As a radical, Joel A. Rogers, in World's Great Men of Color, which has gone through 8 reprint editions, I believe, now. Rogers is, like Harrison, working class scholar. Pullman Porter writes wonderful histories. And I think his portrait of Harrison in World's Great Men of Color is one of the very best, right? And Rogers writes, he describes Hubert Harrison as the foremost Afro-American intellect of his era. And that's amidst chapters on Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, William Monroe Trott, and Marcus Garvey. Extraordinarily high praise. Come in, how you doing? We're just starting, more or less. More or less. All right. So Joel A. Rogers describes Harrison as the foremost Afro-American intellect. Harrison as an intellectual. When Harrison comes to the United States in 1900 from St. Croix, which is where he's born, his mom is from Barbados originally. She's an immigrant. She lived the immigrant experience there. And I go into this in great detail in a biography, but I have to cut some things out in this one. So he goes to school 5 days a week and a couple nights, and then, I mean, not school, he works 5 days a week and a couple nights, and can only go to school a couple days in the evening, right? A couple evenings. He gets citywide honors in New York, a very big city, citywide honors in Latin and high honors and other things. One of the New York dailies, The World, New York World, writes an article headlined, Genius Found in West Indian Student. They had never seen anybody like this. He's barely going to school and he's getting all these honors, right? He spoke or read 6 languages, and we know this from his diary also and everything, to varying degrees, including Arabic. In his last years, he was reading the Quran and teaching himself Arabic, not because he was religious, but because it was a religion of so many people of African descent, right? And he was trying to, you know, learn all of that history. When he died, the obituary said he read voraciously. I had his papers. I inventoried them and documented them. And I've been through his books that remained. They are, you see how he attacked the book. He would pick up a book. He doesn't have to read every chapter, every page, but he would hone in on what he thinks is important, and then he would interact. So to me, it's very believable that he read multiple books in a day, as was said. He also kept voluminous scrapbooks, and it's one. Unfortunately, I don't have all the slides here today. I do have them, but we're not going to show them. But I show you slides of his scrapbooks, and like today, we have people keeping digital files, right? This is how he kept his files back then, and he'd have scrapbooks with different headings, and he would paste into them. So you see the real intellectual process at work. As an orator, Hubert Harrison was a pioneering soapbox orator on history, science, politics, religion, education, literature, theater, evolution, race, and class. He lectures for the Socialist Party when he's with the Socialists as many as 23 times a week, morning, noon, and night. 40,000 people at Union Square, one of the times he's speaking, with others, right? But he also, and I wrote this in for the on one of the anniversaries of the Occupy movement, when Charles Blow recently did a piece on the legacy of the Occupy movement. So I wrote a little letter to the Times saying, well, there's a little more history to this Occupy movement. And I cited the New York Times itself from 1912 describing Hubert Harrison at the corner of Broad and Wall Street in front of the Stock Exchange, speaking for 4 hours on socialism to an audience, an ever-expanding audience, as far as the voice could reach, right? So I said there was a little history of occupying Wall Street, you know?
And
1912. And then Harrison is the pioneering soapbox orator in Harlem in a tradition which gets carried on by Philip Randolph, Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, and many others. He's also with the anarchist and the free speech people fighting for the right to speak in Union Square, upstate in Buffalo. He gets arrested. There's a whole history. And I'll show you a picture of Henry Miller. Henry Miller, in the second volume of his trilogy, writes about Hubert Harrison on his soapbox as his quondam idol. He had never seen an orator like this before. And there are many people. In the biography, the indexes are very extensive. And in the biography, if you look up Harrison's oratory, you can read all these quotes from people about what an orator he was. Still talking about Harrison as an intellectual. In the decade between 1910 and 20, one of the leading left literary publications was The Masses. He edited that for a while in 1911. He then goes on to edit The Voice, a newspaper for the New Negro, in 1917. If people have been taught history in the academy, you'll be taught that the New Negro movement is associated with Alain Locke, 1925, a middle-class arts-based movement. In fact, it starts in 17, the New Negro movement, with Hubert Harrison in a movement based in class and race and social radicalism. But every paper that Hubert Harrison edits is extraordinarily literary. He edits The Voice, the newspaper, from 1917 to 1919. He edits The New Negro in 1919, intended as an organ of the international consciousness of the darker races. He's the principal editor in 1920 of Marcus Garvey's Negro World, and his last newspaper is The Voice of the Negro for that International Colored Unity League that I mentioned. What's important to know is not only is he putting forth ideas on social and political radicalism, but every paper he edits has poetry for the people and book review sections. That's that literary tradition, that aspect. And I'm going to get into in a second what an extraordinary book reviewer he is. So we have this aspect of Harrison as an editor and a journalist, besides all his own writings. Harrison describes himself down here as the first regular book reviewer in Negro newspapers. And we've located about 70 book reviews that he's done. Now, some people up here in Boston, there's a fellow named William Stanley Brathwaite, wins the first. But he's not a regular book reviewer, and it's not Negro newspaper to him. He's writing for the Transcript, so we're in agreement on that, right? Harrison doesn't try and brag falsely. But we're doing all right, right? Okay, so and now Harrison, in 1907, when he's working in the night shift at the post office as a 24-year-old postal worker, he writes two front page articles, New York Times Saturday Review of Books, now it's the Sunday Review of Books, on literary criticism. Front page, the featured articles. To this day, we have two members of the National Book Critics Circle, the editorial board, who have quotes from Hubert Harrison on how to review books on their webpage. Those two people were Scott McLemy and Eric Banks. People may know Scott McLemy also writes for Inside Higher Ed, right? And writes on C.L.R. James and Harrison he's spoken on. Still on Harrison as a critic, Eugene O'Neill wins a Nobel Prize for Literature in 1936. In the 1920s, after Harrison does a review of The Emperor Jones, O'Neill's play, O'Neill is blown away and he writes to Harrison and says, "This is an extraordinary piece. Any theater that I have anything to do with, you have a role in," right? So it is very high praise. And throughout the book, you'll find much more about Harrison as a critic, reviewer, and still talking about Hubert Harrison as an intellectual. He is a pioneer black activist in the socialist movement. He is a pioneer black activist in the free thought movement. We'll get into that a bit more. Free thought is thought unfettered by religion. It was a very big movement in the early part of the 20th century. Pioneer black activist in the birth control movement. Early, speaking on it. He comes out of the same party branch, Socialist Party branch, as Margaret Sanger and her husband William Sanger, right? So he's there speaking on that, and sometimes at great risk. I told the story today. In 1914, he's speaking on birth control, and according to the accounts in the Truth Seeker, which is a free thought newspaper, The Irish cop looks the other way and lets a gang of rowdies attack him, you know, while he's speaking, and he has to take the table leg to defend himself up and down the stairway. So, you know, he'd stick to his guns. He'd speak on what he wanted and had a struggle for that right oftentimes. And Harrison, by the way, gets arrested in that incident, not the people who attacked him. Kind of like today, right? He's a promoter and aide to black writers and artists. U.B. Blake, the musician. Claude McKay, the poet. J.A. Rogers, the historian. Augusta Savage, a sculptress. Sol Plaatt, who's one of the founders of the ANC in South Africa. Right. And on. Charles Gilpin, leading black actor of his day. Harrison is working, interacting, promoting, calling attention to their work. He understands the relation of art and politics and does not try and dictate to the artist, right? We'll talk perhaps more about that. From 22 to 26, he is a featured lecturer for the New York City Board of Education. In New York City, principal form of adult education back in the 20s was night school, right? People would work, and then they'd come, and he would speak, and he was one of the staff, along with teachers from City College, NYU, and Columbia. He was I mentioned Harrison and Allen as autodidacts. Hubert Harrison never goes to a college a day in his life. Theodore W. Allen goes for one day and leaves, according to the story, because it was too confining. So they really are autodidacts. They read on their own. They pursued their intellectual interests with great integrity. That's part of what appeals to me about them. Finally, Harrison was a bibliophile and library popularizer. He collected books. He would sell books when he was speaking on street corner, always trying to encourage people to read. He believed free public libraries were one of the great institutions in this country. He wrote wonderful essays like Read, Read, Read. And he and Arthur Schomburg are two of the five founding officers of what is today the Schomburg Center, with the New York Public Library Division of Negro Prints and Literature. And Harrison and Schomburg would contribute books. Schomburg had more books. Harrison would contribute the books. But Harrison also would do exactly what we're doing here. He would speak every week at the library, bring people in to use the library and access and things.
Schomburg was African American.
Afro-Puerto Rican, Afro-Boriqua, right? And his mom is from St. Croix, same island as Harrison. She was a Joseph. There's more to that story, too, which maybe we'll pick up later. So this is Harrison as an intellectual. Here he is. This is a wonderful photo. I hope you can see it. This is Harrison teaching a course in 1926 on world problems of race. He taught the same course the same year at the Workers' Party School, the Communist Party School in 1926, right? And in this picture, I'm just going to point out some, because this is the generation, the up-and-coming generation of Harlem intellectuals and activists, right? And here's Harrison sitting at the table. Right here is Richard B. Moore. He's a member in early of the African Blood Brotherhood, the Socialist Party, the Communist Party for many years. He is the famed Scottsboro orator in the 1930s, a great fan and follower of Harrison, writes a wonderful piece on Harrison, Dictionary of American Negro Biography. His daughter, Joyce Moore Turner, is about 90 now, a wonderful historian, has written Caribbean Crusaders of the Harlem Renaissance, for University Presses, but she's outside the academy too. Caribbean Crusaders of the Harlem Renaissance and Richard B. Moore, Caribbean Militant in Harlem. She points out, she says, Jeff, make sure you let your audience know that the people in this picture are all there. Since we can't see it on the slides, I'll point out the people, the men are all dressed in sport jackets and suits, and the women are well-dressed. She says, please point out to your audience they are all working people who probably wore service uniforms, the majority of them, during the day, right? But they would come out to get this education. So this is this working class, from the bottom-up approach we see so much in Harrison. Now, other people in this picture right here is W.A. Domingo. Domingo is a socialist. He is the first editor of Marcus Garvey's Negro World. He's from Jamaica, a boyhood friend of Garvey. Goes back to Jamaica subsequently. He also faces persecution for his views. When he goes back to Jamaica, he plays a very important role with Michael Manley and others in the movements for independence and federation in the West Indies, as it was being called by some back then. And Michael Manley is the father of Norman Manley, people may be more familiar with in recent years. Right here is Williana Jones Burroughs, close friend of Harrison. She winds up marrying his best friend, Charles Burroughs, who's a postal worker with Harrison. They'd get off at 3 in the morning and have their study circles, which I appreciate. We used to do the same thing years ago. And Williana Jones Burroughs is a school teacher. for years. She leads in a struggle because married women were prohibited from teaching in the New York City public schools until 19. So she had to struggle and fight against that. But she was a school teacher for many years and had to keep the marriage, the official marriage, secret, and yet struggled against it. She also, now attention's being paid more to her, but she's active in the Communist Party, in the International Communist Movement. She's active in the trade union movement, the early precursor to the teachers union. It was called the teachers union, as I recall, in New York, way back before the one that we later associate with Shanker and things like that. And she also runs for city council in New York, and she goes to the Soviet Union from 1941 to 45. When the Soviet Union is our ally, and does an the United States is ally, and does an English language radio program, there in the Soviet Union to reach out to people, and she and Charles, their son Charles Burroughs, same name as dad, and his wife Dr. Margaret Burroughs, found the DuSable Museum in Chicago, which is one of the nation's leading museums of African American history. So, like Harrison, they pass it on, right? So I think, and in the back is Willianna Jones Burroughs here, and the picture of Willianna Jones Burroughs we have in a book subsequently appears on the front cover of Journal of African American History, so people starting to pay attention to her. In the back is Hermie Weisswood, comes from Suriname, Dutch Guiana back then, and she and her husband Otto Weisswood are very active in the international domestic and international communist movement also. Going to talk about Harrison as a radical. That's A. Philip Randolph, 1963, The March on Washington. A. Philip Randolph is a big follower of Harrison, describes Hubert Harrison as the father of Harlem radicalism. This is in the period when Harlem is considered the center of radical black thought and the international Negro Mecca. Those are phrases that are thrown about. People from down south, from the Caribbean, from Europe, from Africa, would come to Harlem because there was such a ferment of ideas and activism and things like that. Randolph describes Harrison as the father. Hubert Harrison is the only person, I believe, in United States history to play leading signal roles in the largest class radical and the largest race radical movement of his day. He's the leading black activist in the Socialist Party, theoretician and agitator, circa 1912. Many people consider that its heyday. The founder of the first organization, the first newspaper, the New Negro Movement, editor of Garvey's Negro World, shapes that paper when it goes and really takes off internationally. And Robert A. Hill, who's one of the leading experts, generally recognized leading expert on Garvey, is very emphatic that the Garvey movement is a component part of the New Negro movement, right? So Harrison plays these leading roles in both the largest class radical and race radical movement of the era. Here's his publication, New Negro, 1919. Again, 6 years before Alain Locke. You can see some of the topics: the women of our race, education in West Africa, the white war and the colored races, talking about World War I, two Negro radicalisms. So talking about a lot of very interesting topics. Here's Randolph. Hubert Harrison was the major radical influence on A. Philip Randolph. And I have quotes in the book, to back this stuff up. The major radical influence on Marcus Garvey. Many quotes to back this up. When I grow up, that's Martin and Malcolm. Martin, as you know, marches alongside A. Philip Randolph in the March on Washington. Malcolm, his father was a Garveyite preacher, and his mother was a reporter for the Negro World, the same paper that Harrison edited. I argue that Harrison, Hubert Harrison, is a key link in the ideological unity of these two wings of the civil rights black liberation struggle, the class labor one and the race nationalist one. They have roots back in Harrison, so we want to look more deeply, what's he offering? I argue Harrison profoundly influenced a generation of new Negro militants and common people. And we'll get into this more, too. But when Harrison first moves to New York in 1900, he lives on West 62nd Street, 3,500 people in five blocks, densely packed, mostly African and Afro-Caribbean community. When the IRT subway gets completed, goes up to Harlem in 1904, Harrison then moves to Harlem. He lives on 134th Street in Harlem. It's the most densely populated block in Harlem. He's rooted in the community. He's not on the hill. He's not on high, right? I argue in my two books, and I will in Volume 3, amongst his generation of the black activists, he's the most class-conscious of the race radicals and the most race-conscious of the class radicals. Intriguing combination. He is also a radical internationalist. And I think back when I first started writing, and he would be dismissed in half a sentence by those who would even mention him. Hubert Harrison, the black socialist, black nationalist. He describes himself as a radical internationalist. And people should know that, and they want to pay some attention to that. Winston James is an excellent historian. He's written one wonderful book he's written. He's written other things that are also wonderful. But the one I want to focus on is Holding Aloft the Banner of Ethiopia, about early 20th century Caribbean radicalism. And in that book, he points out that amongst his generation, Hubert Harrison knew more about and spoke and wrote more knowledgeably about Africa than any of his contemporaries, but he did so without the arrogance that so often comes from people in this country towards people from Africa. On Asia, I have scholars from India who've written me and say what Harrison wrote in the period, particularly around World War I, 1919, about India is the best that they have seen coming out of this country, talking about India as the Achilles heel of British imperialism, giving whole analysis. And Harrison writes lectures on China. He never goes to college a day in his life, but in 1926, in the period of the Canton Uprising, he is lecturing at Columbia, and in a series of lectures on developments in China, right? He writes on the Mideast and the develop of struggle in the Arab world, and he's the one who starts the West Indian news notes in Garvey's Negro World, right? How you doing? So he is a giant, but he's a radical internationalist. Going on, just going to add a little more on this. Richard B. Moore, who I showed you earlier, says Harrison was above all the militant black socialists in his steady emphasis on the liberation of the oppressed African and colonial peoples. Winston James, who I mentioned also, says Harrison had confidence in and humility before the peoples and culture of Africa. Harrison also identified with all the African traditions and continuities in St. Croix. He knew that history. And again, when I spoke here last time, I mentioned Alan mentions that the migration from Africa was the largest migration between 1500 and 1900 to the Americas as a whole. And we never want to lose sight of that, right? And Harrison understands those roots. Finally, Harrison was, this is Winston James again, was primarily a teacher, not a primitive, of Africa was primarily a teacher, not a primitive unschooled child in need of civilization. And if people are not familiar with what he's referring to, Marcus Garvey founds his UNIA, Universal Negro Improvement, and African Communities, in parentheses, Imperial League, in 1914. And he lays out the objects, the objectives of the organization. And number five pertains to bringing civilization and culture to the African peoples, right? And that's one of the areas where Harrison differs very much from Garvey. Harrison thinks there's much to learn from Africa. There's much tradition, much wisdom, and he respects African leaders, whereas Garvey is on that civilizing mission, at least as articulated in the program. There are other differences, but Harrison talks about this. This will come out in Volume 2, mostly. As a radical internationalist, here's what Harrison writes about himself. Although I am not satisfied with American conditions as they are now, I realize that in these days of change and unrest, I would not have been satisfied anywhere else. In China, I would be fighting against foreign domination. In Egypt, India, South Africa, or West Africa, I would be fighting against the British oligarchs. In Jamaica, against the sinister repression of black people practiced by both whites and mulattoes, and in the Dutch, French, or American West Indies, against crackerism, stupidity, or cowardice. So he knows what side he'd be on, wherever he was, right? This is Hodge Kiernan, right, from Montserrat, another brilliant working-class intellectual of the era, edits a publication called The Promoter in 1920. He is, I think it's a stunning photo, and he's one who emphasizes Harrison's ties to the common people. I have a longer quote, which I pulled here. But I like this photo also because he worked at the Stieglitz Arts Gallery. This is the period of all these deferment in art and stuff in the teens in New York. And the Stieglitz Gallery was where a lot of exhibits would come, and, you know, all the new art. He was the elevator operator, and as I've pointed out many times, probably the most brilliant person in the building, right? So Harrison's approach, he's race conscious, he's class conscious, he's scientific, he's internationalist, he emphasizes the common people. In his day, he's a master of the mass approach. This is pre-TV and pre-radio, particularly the period I'm talking about, pre-1918. So the two principal ways of reaching the masses are soapbox oratory and newspapers, periodicals, and he's a master of each. He's a brilliant journalist and a great, unrivaled soapbox orator by all accounts, right? He's a big proponent of direct action, and this partly comes from his Crucian roots. We will talk slightly about this, but also you'll see it in support for the IWW and many other things. He understands the interrelation of literature and the arts. He's anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, and scientific, and throughout everything, as his children always stress to me and encourage me to emphasize, he challenges white supremacy in all his activities. So you're getting a little picture of Harrison then. When Harrison dies in 1927...
Would you prefer people held their questions for a while?
Yes, at the end. We'll deal with them. I'll stay. I'm ready to stay. 1927, when Harrison dies unexpectedly from appendicitis, at his funeral, thousands attend his funeral in Harlem. He had been incredibly popular. The kids used to follow him down the street. He lived amongst the people. People knew him. He spoke, interacted with everybody. Thousands attended. He was held in high regard. Arthur Schomburg, one of his friends, delivered the eulogy. He knew how popular Harrison was and how influential he was, but he also eulogized that Hubert Harrison was ahead of his time. Yeah. And I think that's very insightful. I think it's very accurate, because I think Harrison has much to offer us today, and that's why, partly why I'm writing on him. That's why in that article in Cultural Logic, some insights from Harrison and Allen, because I tried to bring it up to date a little and suggest some ways. Here's Hubert Harrison's gravesite, Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. For people who can't see the picture, it is an unmarked, shared gravesite in Woodlawn Cemetery. I use that picture for two reasons. One, it suggests the poverty he and his family lived in. Two, it suggests the lack of recognition he's received in his lifetime. There's now efforts underway to commemorate that site. When I do the longer presentations on his St. Croix roots, I get into St. Croix as a colony, capitalist slavery, the immigrant relations, you know, in his family, the history of direct action, many important aspects, which is the first volume, first chapter of that volume. I'm going to short-circuit to one particular issue I want to focus on, which I think is crucial for work here in the U.S., and this is only because I'm trying to keep this down a little bit. Here's a picture of the estate where Hubert Harrison is born, the plantation where he is born in St. Croix. And you will see that the estate is owned by two men of color. You would not find that in Virginia or down south in the U.S., right? And that gets into the point that I want to make is, if you will, the color line, if you will, was drawn differently in St. Croix and in the Anglo-Caribbean than in the U.S. down south. And here's what I mean by that. In St. Croix, there was a policy of promotion, not strict proscription, for a significant sector of the African-descended population. How this manifests itself, there was no formal segregation, no history of lynch terror, and white supremacy was not as virulent or as organized as in the U.S. Why? Has to do with social control, what those Theodore W. Allen books talk about. Volume 1 is Racial Oppression and Social Control. Social control is key. You can have national oppression, you can have racial, but they're different forms. They're still oppressions, but they're different forms of maintaining social control. In St. Croix, you have at the top of the society in general 5% primarily European at the very top of the society. You have 80% of the population, this is in Harrison's period and even earlier, you know, under slavery. 80% of the population was black plantation laborers, 15% colored of mixed African and European ancestry, so-called free colored. All right. The European ruling elite of 5% could not maintain control over the 95% by itself. So it tried to utilize the 15%. C.L.R. James, when he writes about Saint-Domingue, about Haiti, discusses similar things. And what happened in St. Croix, which has an emancipation victory after Haiti, as in Haiti, when push comes to shove in that struggle, the free colored side with the African enslaved population, and they win emancipation. It's very similar in St. Croix, and I talk about this in the book. But during slavery and in this early period, what happens, just to show the difference again between the U.S. and Virginia, and Virginia, Allen's Volume 2 is on the origin of racial oppression in Anglo-America, 17th century Virginia, where white doesn't appear until 1691. He talks about how the white race gets set up as a ruling class social control formation, not simply a social construct. It's driven by the ruling class to maintain social control. It's done by implementing white race privileges that are not only against the African-American population, but against the interests of the laboring class Europeans. That was the talk we did last time here. Now, regarding St. Croix, in the period going back, in the period when there was slavery in the island, and St. Croix is similar to Barbados and Jamaica in what I'm going to say, even though it's a Danish colony, but the English was the language on it, and they're very similar in so many respects. And Alan talks about both Barbados and Jamaica in the same light. But in St. Croix, the free coloreds served in the militia. That was the principal instrument of social control. Down south, what was the principal instrument of social control during slavery? The slave patrol, Lily White, by definition. Marked contrast. In 1834, in St. Croix, free coloreds were extended an edict of full equality, a law that at least nominally granted full equality between free coloreds and whites, or Europeans, right? What's the law of the land in the U.S.? The Dred Scott decision, 1856-57. No black person has any rights that a white is bound to respect. Promotion of a sector of the African descendant population, as I showed you, Harrison's estate is owned by people of color. It was due to a policy of land, granting land and to people, whereas in the U.S. South you would never have that. People weren't allowed to rise like that, if you will, right? Or virtually never. Early in the 1700s you had some of that, but not after they set up racial slavery. Claude McKay comes from Jamaica. When Harrison comes from St. Croix, when Marcus Garvey comes from Jamaica, when Claude McKay comes from Jamaica, all these early 20th century Afro-Caribbean activists, they all comment similarly. They've never seen anything like what they encounter here. Claude McKay articulates it very well. He writes, when he came to the U.S., it was the first time I had ever come face to face with such manifest, implacable hatred of my race, and my feelings were indescribable. They'd never seen anything like this. Here's Harrison when he first arrived, around the time he first arrives in 1900. And when Harrison arrives in 1900, it's shortly after New York City's fourth great race riot. Harper's Magazine, which is still published today, writes back then in 1900 that it was said that a black man could not walk from 23rd Street to 42nd Street without fear of being seized by a mob, right? This was the atmosphere in the city. And that's what Harrison encounters. This is the year he arrives. In that year alone, at least 107 African-Americans were lynched. Here are four at one time down in Georgia. As I said, this was unknown in St. Croix. And Harrison, this is the first issue that Harrison writes on. Between 1903 and 1910, he writes 12, starting in high school, he writes 12 articles, letters or pieces to the New York Times to get published, right? And the first issue he writes on is lynching, and as he writes in that article, he talks about the racial oppression his people feel, and he's shocked. Shocked is the word he used. And Alan elaborates on that more in his books again, and I have notes that tie these two together. What Harrison proceeds to do with others is he involves and he develops in black working class intellectual circles. Is a very vibrant community amongst black working class people. And included in that community are Schomburg, who is a clerk, right? Johnny Bruce, one of the leading black journalists of the day, who is a messenger. I'm going to get into some other names in a second, and I've cut some out. But Harrison does this at two main places, St. Benedict the Moor Church on 53rd Street and St. Mark's AME Church on 53rd Street. That used to be an area before the IRT. Harrison's living on 62nd. You come down to 53rd. Still, there's a history of music on 53rd Street, jazz and stuff like that. People familiar with New York. But they had these two churches. St. Benedict the Moor Church is still there, right, on 53rd Street. And Harrison talks about St. Benedict's being the germ of black racial consciousness. First off, it was a place where African Americans and Afro-Caribbeans could come together because there was tension in that early period, immigrant group, native-born. Harrison talks about how the fiercest opposition in debate could not take from the cordiality of personal friendship. And at St. Benedict's, we learned to insist on the right to differ, to criticize, and to dissent from that which we believe to be wrong, and to do this openly and publicly without beating the devil around the stump. That is the type of intellectual atmosphere I think we need today. I think that, and this is done by black working class people, I think it's very exemplary. in what they were accomplishing. They would bring speakers. They're doing what we're doing here. Speakers, activities, discussions. Maybe we disagree on this issue. Let's go out and talk. You know, it's possible. I come from that generation, late 60s, early 70s. At a certain point, people were eating each other up, you know, but I think there's something to learn in some of this. All right, here's Charles Burroughs, Harrison's co-worker in the post office, and there were others, Nelson, Lee, there's a bunch of them. As I said, they would get together after that night shift, right, and do it. And I mentioned Burroughs also. He's an actor. He was a great actor, and he founds the Kriegel Players, one of the early black theater groups, in the basement of the public library in 1926. But he would go down to historically black colleges and do one-man Shakespeare renditions way back when he get his time off from the post office. And here's his wife, Williana Jones. This is the picture that they subsequently took from the Harrison... Not that they took from the Harrison, but appeared in the Harrison biography, and then it ran on the front cover of Journal of African American History. One of the places that Harrison involved in order to get fully integrated and come to know his community was the White Rose Home. White Rose Home was set up in New York. It originally was started by a woman named Victoria Earle Matthews, one of the leading black women activists of the late 19th century. She's a journalist. She's a fighter for equal rights. And she founds this home. The woman right here in this picture, Frances Reynolds Kaiser, and I'm going to... Here's another picture of Frances Reynolds Kaiser. But Frances Reynolds Kaiser really runs the place. And Frances Reynolds Kaiser is one of the first women graduates of what became Hunter College in New York. And she also is active in civil rights activities, the work here. She is a founding member of the NAACP Executive Board. She's a woman that really needs a biography. I mean, there's much that need and should be written about her. But she's also a couple of other things. She is the close enough confidant with Paul Laurence Dunbar, the leading late 19th, early 20th century poet, that he sends his work to her before he sends it to the publisher for her to go over it, right? She is so close a confidant to Hubert Harrison that he writes to her describing his torturous break from religion. Religion is a worldview, and when he breaks from religion, he explains it to her in a very detailed correspondence, which is included... Essentially, it's included in both volumes, but you can see the exact text in the reader. And then, subsequently, when she leaves the White Rose Home, she goes down to Florida to work with Mary McLeod Bethune and to run that school in Florida, Daytona School, right? So these are giants in black history, and she's very intimate. So she really is a fascinating person, as I said, a person in need of struggle. So what Harrison does now, at the White Rose Home, you would have black women coming from down south, from the Caribbean, perhaps from Africa, you know, but mostly down south in the Caribbean. When they came to the big city, they would be provided a place to stay. They could go out and get jobs. There was child care for their children in a kindergarten class. Harrison, at no pay, taught the race history class there and taught the kindergarten class for the youngsters, right? Again, just trying to, you know, involve.
Still need it.
Huh?
Still need it.
Yeah, right. And he explains, you know, why he's doing that to fully understand, but it's good work. And there's Mary. Here's his break from religion. This is partly what he details in his letter to Miss Kaiser. I divorced myself from Orthodox and institutional Christianity. He read all the church. And this is the period of historical criticism, early 20th century. So he's reading all the church literature, and, you know, it's not making sense, the stories, you know, putting it together. And what had gone was the authenticity of the Bible, that which I had been taught was the Word of God. I now had a new belief, agnosticism. I said belief. What I meant was a philosophy of life. Now I am an agnostic, as Thomas Huxley was. Thomas Huxley coined the phrase agnostic. And he goes, to Huxley, agnosticism was not a creed, but a method, the essence of which was the fundamental axiom of modern science. Right? He's turning to science. You follow your reason as far as it will take you, and you do not pretend that conclusions are certain which are not demonstrated or demonstrable. In his diary, Harrison concluded that he would never be anything but an honest agnostic, because, as he wrote, I prefer to go to the grave with my eyes wide open. That's Harrison's turn. And it's a torturous break for him. And it has to be put in the context. The black church is the most powerful institution in the black community. And here he is breaking from the black church, right? But he's going to use social approach to address social problems. A scientific approach, you know, rather than... So, free thought was very current in that period. It was thought free of religious dogma. It emphasized human origins as the Old and New Testaments, denied the infallibility of the Bible, denied the existence of heaven and hell, emphasized reason over supernatural authority, and encouraged free inquiry, free discussion, and free publicity of ideas, and the scientific method. Amongst early 20th century free thinkers, if people are not familiar with the movement, leaders in the women's movement, or some of these are from 19th century, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, Margaret Sanger, Horace Greeley, the anti-slavery editor, Boston's own Thomas Wentworth Higginson, Clarence Darrow, Eugene Debs, Mark Twain, Lucy Parsons, Emma Goldman, two first early leaders of the Communist Party, Louis Freina and Charles E. Ruthenberg, A. Philip Randolph, and amongst black activists, amongst others, J. A. Rogers, Claude McKay, Cyril V. Briggs, one of the founders of the African Blood Brotherhood, Richard B. Moore, who I've mentioned, Kiernan, who I showed you, and even Du Bois, although it's not emphasized, his biographer, David Levering Lewis, writes, this is not in the biography, this is elsewhere, writes, as indicated by his biographer, David Levering Lewis was an agnostic and an anti-clerical. Here's Harrison's wife, Irene Louise Horton Harrison. She comes from Demerara. That's a region it was Dutch Guiana, now it's Suriname, right, in South America. Demerara is a region where Africans would escape, you know, into the interior, you know, to escape from their bondage in down there. And she comes by way of Antigua, Puerto Rico, and up to the U.S., and they marry in late 1908, I believe, as I recall. Here's where they live, 231 West 134th Street, most densely populated block in Harlem. I took this photo in 1990. That's why the broken windows and everything. That was the high point of crack in, you know, New York. I think the government was letting it in that period, right? Doing so worldwide. Harrison's criticism of NAACP. 1909, 1910, the NAACP gets formed. It's after the Springfield, Illinois, quote, race riots. Activists meet in New York, and they have some meetings downtown. European-American, African-American activists, and they discuss setting up this organization. In the meetings that they call together to discuss the founding of this organization, there are some reports that come out in the press the next few days. In those reports, during the meetings, some of the African-American activists really articulated some pretty strong critiques of what was going on, pointed criticisms. But when the reports come out in the press, those comments are elided, they're taken out. Harrison warns, this is no way to start this organization. You cannot shape this organization to white people's expectations of how black people should act, right? So it's an early warning sign. And overall, he starts developing the criticism in that first decade that the NAACP, and we're going to explain this in more detail in a second, had no answer to the basic question, what will you do if the white people whose minds you're trying to reach do not respond? In other words, it had no proactive policy. That's his early developing criticism. Now, in 1910, W.E.B. Du Bois becomes editor of the Crisis Magazine, which is a publication of the NAACP. Du Bois, as you know, is associated with the concept of the talented... Now, Du Bois, when Harrison first comes, he's critical, you know, in that first decade, he's critical of Booker T. Washington. He considers himself a Du Bois man, right? And Du Bois and Schroeder had founded the Niagara Movement. Harrison's in that line of, you know, protest against the philosophy of Booker T. Washington. But Du Bois is associated with this concept, the talented tenth, which he described as the educated and gifted who must be made leaders of thought and missionaries of culture among their people. Harrison had some issues with this concept, and here are three of the issues. One, he didn't think the talented tenth had provided the leadership that was necessary. Two, he thought that the talented tenth should come down from their Mount Sinai and get amongst the people. And three, he didn't think that the, quote, colored leadership, and he's talking now about the makeup of that talented tenth, and he's not being mean-spirited, but oftentimes, and there are statistics, and there's been reports and studies done, so-called talented tenth were oftentimes those of mixed ancestry, and he did not think that having white blood preordained somebody to be a leader of the black race, and he would elaborate on that later. But these were some of his early criticisms, right? Going on. He considered Booker T. Washington a subservient, right? Booker T. Washington was the most powerful black man in America by virtue of his ties to powerful whites, the Carnegies, the Rosenwalds, people like this. And he had a political machine. It was called the Tuskegee Machine. And they would reward their friends and punish their enemies pretty viciously at times. In around 1906, Washington said of President Theodore Roosevelt, please pay attention to this. This is a quote. I will oppose nothing that he wants done and will help forward all that he desires to have done. That seems to qualify as a subservient attitude towards Teddy Roosevelt. So Harrison kept scrapbooks, as I mentioned, and one was subservience, and prominent in that scrapbook was Du Bois. It was Booker T. Now what happens is, in 1910, Booker T. Washington goes to London and Copenhagen to talk, you know, deliver some talks, and he basically argues that conditions were not so bad for black people back in the United States, right? Yeah, he got his audiences there and everything like that. Du Bois reads this. There's accounts being relayed back to the U.S., and Du Bois reads this, and he puts together a group of about 40 or 50 very prominent leaders, and they issue protest, you know, justifiable protest about what Booker T. Washington's saying. Hubert Harrison is working in the post office at the time, and he writes two letters to the New York Sun, which is a daily newspaper, and what he basically says is, well, Booker T. is free to say what he wants, but he really should tell the truth. And then he runs the list of what's going on. Booker T. is not going to tolerate that too tough. So here's Booker T. Washington in this photo. Next to him is Emmett Scott, his right hand, as they swing the Tuskegee machine into action. And one of their contacts in New York is a fellow named Charles Anderson, who's a leading black Republican who's part of the Tuskegee machine. Anderson is also close friends with a fellow named Edmund Morgan, who's the postmaster of New York City Post Office. Post Office is not supposed to be political, but that's not the case, right? And Morgan, to this day, for those familiar with New York, the largest post office in New York at 29th Street and 10th Avenue is Morgan Station. It is named after Morgan. So you get, when you do bad things, you get buildings built in your honor.
What year is this?
This is 1910 when he goes and speaks. So what happens is they swing into action, and then the correspondence goes back and forth, and I have the correspondence linked to on my webpage, and it's in the Booker T. Washington papers, which are available online, and you see the smoking gun letters where they talk about, they go to get Harrison, and then they talk about, we got him, right? And Harrison is summarily fired from the post office. Now, when he's fired, he has a wife and five children. It's a dastardly thing. It's devastating for a working person. It's about as vicious a thing as can happen. I worked 33 years in the post office. I was active in the union. I knew how to get the records. I wrote to St. Louis. I got his POD-7. That's post office department there. Had a clean record. Nothing on him. And he's fired summarily, right? For the remainder of his life, he lives in poverty. As I've mentioned to others, within the past few years, there's been a new biography coming out about Booker Washington. Let's take a new look. Let's reassess Booker T. You know, doesn't mention this. If you're going to write a biography, you got warts and all, right, so to speak. You got to look at this and you got to discuss this. But this is a vicious, dastardly thing. And Harrison, as I said, he and his family in poverty for the remainder of his life. After he dies in 1920, they can't even put a monument on his grave. Two of his daughters, still living in poverty, die from tuberculosis during the Depression. You know, I mean, you know, it's always at the edge of poverty, always. Socialist Party. So he joins the Socialist Party after he loses his postal job. He had been with the Socialist Party, but now he becomes full-time active with the Socialist Party. Socialist Party, in this period, 1908, it had 40,000 members, 400,000 votes, 3%. By 1912, it goes up to 6%. It's a growing party. Debs is campaigning in 1912, the fifth time he's running for president. Harrison is out campaigning. Harrison's one of their finest campaigners, with his, you know, on the street corners and things like that. Its 1908 platform is very progressive. It included things which we could use today. Anti-monopolies and trust, pro-nationalization of industries, 8-hour workday, graduated income, progressive income taxation, only party that supports women's suffrage, public works programs, not a bad, you know, had some good ideas. And so it's a growing party. It had very small percentage of, relatively low percentage of women, and very small percentage, 1% perhaps, of African Americans. But there was also movement in the Socialist Party for women's clubs and foreign language federations, right? People were trying to explore. So Harrison saw what was going on, and he started, and once he gets active in the party, he pushes for a colored socialist club, you know, to start. And it wasn't going to be only black people, but it was going to be to discuss and reach out to reach, you know, more African Americans, Afro-Caribbeans. All right. So Harrison writes the first major theoretical series by a black, by an African American, black Caribbean, black activist on the Negro and Socialism in the Socialist Party Press. And he writes it in the New York Call and then in the International Socialist Review. In his writing, Harrison develops such ideas as the following. Have to understand racial oppression as socio-historical, not biological. He proposes a new litmus test for the Socialist Party, champion the cause of the African American as a revolutionary doctrine. This is revolutionary to do this in this country, he's arguing, right? This is key. He argues consistently for the duty of all members of the party to oppose race prejudice, and he develops plans for this colored socialist club. When Harrison joins the Socialist Party, the two main factions of the party are called the Evolutionary Socialist and the Revolutionary Socialist. The Evolutionary Socialist wanted to try and elect people to office, and gradually we're going to, you know, vote in a change in government. The Revolutionary Socialists wanted more direct militant action. You know, we'll have strikes and the like, and we'll move towards, a revolutionary switch to socialism. Harrison tried to appeal to both wings of the party, and he said for the political socialists, you want to elect people to office, you need black votes. To the people who wanted militant labor action and the like, he says, if you want militant labor action, you need black workers. You know, so he's trying to talk to each in their own language. And he's suggesting consistently that the duty to champion the cause of the Negroes is the key to addressing the question, which first comes out in 1906 in a book by Werner, not doesn't first come out, but had been articulated in 1906 by a book by Werner Sombart called Why No Socialism in the U.S.? You know, Sombart started posing that question. Others have also. What particularly struck me 30-some-odd years ago when I first got attracted to Harrison and I read his books on microfilm, I went to the Schomburg Library, and you could get the old-timers remember this. You get the books, and then you print them out, you know, page by page, take it home and read it. And he wrote two books, Negro and the Nation, 1917, and When Africa Wakes, in 1920. And I read his books, and what struck me was this, because from Allen and from my years of experience in the labor movement, I am very clear in my mind that the two arguments that undermine efforts at struggling against white supremacy by European Americans are the following two arguments. These are the ideological arguments in all their various forms. The first is that racism is innate. Because if racism is innate, why fight it, right? It's innate. You can't do anything about it. Second argument is that white workers benefit from racism. Because if white workers benefit, why should they fight it, right? Now, we know the people at top benefit, we're clear on that, and we know there's privileges all over, but what Allen argues is for working people, those privileges are a poison bait. It's like a shot of heroin. It looks good, but it's, you know, not in your interest. But you see that, and Harrison is making these arguments back then. And I said, wow, because I was familiar with Allen, right? Here, if you don't get anything else from today, I hope you'll remember this. This is Harrison writing in 1912. And the social, you okay?
Yep, yep.
Okay, in the Socialist Party Press, he writes, politically, the Negro is the touchstone of the modern democratic idea. Please remember that concept, the touchstone concept. A touchstone is a black stone. You rub it against the metal to see if it's really gold or not. It's an extraordinary metaphor. Any issue we look at in society, housing, education, employment, health care, life expectancy, incarceration. Let's put it to the test. How are black people faring? What are we going to do about it? It's a guide to action. He goes on in that same passage to write, He goes on to write in that same passage that true democracy and equality, essentially he writes this, true democracy and equality for the Negroes, and this is his words, implies a revolution startling to even think of. I think that statement foreshadows the 1960s, the era I grew up in, when the civil rights, black liberation struggle is a catalyst for social change, catalyst for the student movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, people of color movements, you know, gay and lesbian rights. All these movements take sustenance from the civil rights, black liberation struggle. Two main reasons, I think. One, because the struggle was just, the people were right out there. I mean, you're moved by it, you knew it was right. Two, because it hit directly at how the ruling class maintained social control in this country, white supremacy being so central to it. So, and Harrison goes on, I'll better throw this one in, we're at the Marxist Center now. He also talks about, as long as the color line exists, the cant of democracy is dust in the eyes of white voters. This is going to get into Harrison's understanding of democracy. But I like this dust in the eyes of white voters because for me it immediately brought to mind Du Bois in Black Reconstruction when he writes about the American blind spot. And Allen, in his early work, when he writes about the white blind spot, basically how white supremacy blinds people, right? And here's Harrison talking about dust in the eyes of white voters. But here's his quote. This is what Harrison writes during World War I. It's a little late. I'm foreshadowing here a little. But this could have been written, particularly when George Bush leads us into the war in Iraq to bring democracy to the Middle East. But here's Harrison writing World War I. If you remember, Woodrow Wilson leads us into war to make the world safe for democracy, right? Harrison writes, during the World War, the idea of democracy was widely advertised, mainly as convenient camouflage behind which competing imperialists masked their sordid aims. Those who so loudly proclaimed the new democratic demands never had the slightest intention of extending democracy, right? But they'll use that. I argue that Hubert Harrison understood the twofold character of democracy, and certainly because I'm at the Marxist Center, I want to elaborate on that a little bit. In 1868, Marx writes to Engels, talking about Capital, these big volumes, very thick, you know, hard to read and everything, and he explains, well, at its core, it's not so difficult, and we begin with a basic concept, the dual character of labor as absolute value, right? So that, from Marx, and I remember that dual character because I think Harrison understands that in terms of democracy. And by that I mean when you have a lily-white democracy, a whites-only democracy, a white primary, a lily-white Democratic or Republican Party, when you have these lily-white or essentially lily-white gerrymandered Tea Party congressional districts, which is what they're doing now, well, it's a retardant to social progress. When you have struggles for genuine equality, people coming together and waging those struggles, it's a catalyst for social change. And I think Harrison understood that. All right, here he is. No, this is Debs, 1912. We're going on with the story in the Socialist Party. Henry Miller, as I mentioned earlier, he used to follow Harrison around a little bit when Harrison was speaking, Madison Square, places like this. In the second volume of his trilogy, Nexus Play, might be Plexus, I'm not sure which one. And he's a socialist in his youth, Henry Miller. He describes Harrison as quantum idol, and if you can read the quotes in both my books, but it's about a three-paragraph quote about Harrison as an orator. It's really moving and stunning. Here's Harrison in the leading journal of the Socialist Party, National Journal, International Socialist Review. People are probably familiar with Rudyard Kipling, writes The White Man's Burden. Harrison writes a response, The Black Man's Burden. He goes, and he begins, let's look at the facts, right? So you've got to... Here is Harrison, right prior to the 1912 Socialist Party Convention, high point for the socialists. Harrison says, the duty of the party is to champion the Negro, Southernism or socialism. What's going to be the direction for this party? He poses that right before the convention. The party meets in convention in Indiana, and they don't even discuss the Negro question. Do not even discuss it. But they do discuss Asian immigration. And in the debates on Asian immigration, which they come out with some of the most vicious white supremacist words and language in the history of the party. Victor Berger, this is a white man's party, and so on. And I cite some of these things. And he's a leading socialist, right? And they come out with a resolution. And here's the resolution on Asian immigration. I'm going to read the bottom part that I've cited here. Class consciousness must be learned, but race consciousness is inborn and cannot be wholly unlearned. That's the core of the racism is innate argument, right? And there it is in the leading party, the Socialist Party, leading left group in the country at the time. Harrison never lets them forget that. He'd come back, have you changed from this position yet? Have you changed from this position yet? He does something else which I think is very important and very profound, and particularly in terms of the history of the left, the subsequent history of the left. He writes, and here's the first sentences in this article on the Negro, Socialism and the Negro. The 10 million Negroes of America form a group that is more essentially proletarian, and under slavery were the most thoroughly exploited of the American proletariat. This is crucial, I believe, and you see it in Allen, particularly in his invention of the white race. The understanding that slavery was capitalist, slave owners were capitalist, and the chattel bond laborers, European American or African American, were proletarians, they're workers. And we see this in Harrison in 1912. We see it in Du Bois in his Black Reconstruction, which reinterprets our understanding of U.S. history, when Du Bois writes, at the time of Civil War and Reconstruction, the labor movement, with few exceptions, never had the intelligence or knowledge as a whole to see in Black slavery and Reconstruction the kernel and meaning of the labor movement. When Allen writes The Invention of the White Race, he tears up all those arguments that chattel bondage is a feudal carryover of this or that, which you'll see in a lot of the history that comes out of the left movement when they try and develop theories in the semi-peasantry and the semi-feudal South. You know, it's very important what's being argued here. And why is it important? For several reasons. I'm going to point out three. One, if we exclude black plantation labor from the proletariat, we remove two centuries of valiant struggle by black labor from our labor history, right? We remove some of the most valiant struggles in our labor history. Two, if we remove black labor from the proletariat, we provide a cover for class betrayal by so-called white labor of black labor. If you read these early histories in the 1800s of the labor movement and stuff, and they'll talk and they'll develop rationales for why white labor couldn't support abolition. Well, we're worker class. We got interests in slaves, somehow different interests and things like that. That's not what Marx said. That's not what the English Chartists said, right? They understood you support abolition and things like that. And third, and this is what Allen develops in his Invention of the White Race, and in that Developing Conjuncture article, I elaborate on all this, but Allen thinks it's crucial to understand black labor as proletarian if you want to get at the real essence and nature and origin and invention of the white race, how it is invented as a ruling class social control formation serving the interest of that plantation bourgeoisie originally and subsequently ruling classes. Harrison moves increasingly to the left wing in the Socialist Party, supports Big Bill Haywood, issues a sabotage, he's a proponent of direct action. He likes that they're doing interracial organizing, one big union, their militancy, many things about the IWWP, but they're not very big in New York, New Jersey, area where he lives. They're big up here in 1912 in Lawrence, right? And they're big in Patterson in 1913. They're very active. And Harrison, here's Harrison in 1913 at the Patterson strike, and there he is with Gurley Flynn and Big Bill Haywood and some of the Wobbly Or. He's a great, goes out to Patterson a couple of times, addresses all the Patterson strikers, and the press really, they're really bent out of shape about some of, you know, his speech, because he's very militant. He winds up leaving the Socialist Party. I'm moving ahead quickly on this story. It's got segregated locals in the South. There are instances where he's treated in ways that he, you know, is very critical of. He winds up leaving the Socialist Party, and when he leaves the Socialist Party, he offers what I think is arguably the most profound but least heeded criticism in the history of the left in this country. And it's unfortunate that for so many years we did not know more about Harrison and did not know more about this. But what he argues is the Socialist Party, like the labor movement, has insisted on white race first and class after, that it put the white race first before class. And I think this leads us directly to the work of Theodore W. Allen. Again, what is this white race thing? You know, that's where we go. Moving on with Harrison's story. So he leaves the Socialist Party, and he's going to go independent for a while. He's active. He tried to set up a radical forum, speaking outdoors and indoors in 1914-15, active in the free thought movement, free speech movement, birth control movement. He's talking on the racial aspects of World War I.
What month?
1914 and 15. I'm thinking April right now, but I'd be
1914 or 15?
Yeah, 14. He's. I've not seen formal resignation papers. You know, he just kind of moves away and does. Later on, he says he rejoins. So I take it that's when he, if I recall correctly. But it's in 1914. But there's been things, and he's been written, and particularly after he defends some of the Patterson strikers, he's really taking on. He thinks the Socialist Party's betrayal of some of the Patterson strikers and also of Haywood, he thinks is a real stab in the back of the movement. He says so openly, invokes the wrath of party leadership. But so he's speaking on this stuff in 1914 and 15. He teaches at the Modern School, which is a very avant-garde school in New York. The original Modern School movement is started by Francisco Ferrer in Spain in around 1909. Kind of an anarchist, but, you know, other things he's also into. He's executed by a combination of church and state in Spain, but the movement, it goes international, right? And in New York, at the Modern School, in a fellow named I don't know how you pronounce it, A-B-R-I-A-C-H, Avrich, has written on this, and others have talked about it, but anarchism, socialism, syndicalism, revolution, birth control, free love, all these modern currents are being discussed. Emma Goldman, Berkman, Clarence Starrett, they've got, you know, people, Will Durant, philosophers, they've got activists and lefties and artists, they're discussing all this ferment and the period, and Harrison is talking. When he teaches there, he's teaching comparative religion courses, right? In this period, he's very outspoken on his criticisms of Christianity. Christian America created the color line. Church saw to it that religion taught to slaves should stress servile virtues of subservience and content. When the fight for the abolition of slavery was on, Christian church gagged the mouths of the adherents who dared to protest. The church among Negroes today exerts a more powerful influence than anything else. Show me a population that is deeply religious and I will show you a servile population. He goes on and on. So this, again, this is the most powerful institution in the black community. Going on with the story, he makes two predictions on the racial significance of World War I. He also writes, and I don't have it here, but he writes on the economic causes behind war, which could have been in my, on a quick view, and I have it quoted in both books, could have been written by Lenin, about talking about capitalism and then imperialism, development, the search for markets. It's wonderful stuff. But he also talks on the racial significance of the war, and particularly points out how this war in Europe and elsewhere is going to lead to awakening racial and national consciences internationally and to domestically to an increasing tide of racial consciousness, right? He winds up making his turn to concentrated work in the black community. He's prodded by James Weldon Johnson, who calls Harrison's lectures a university education in the street. James Weldon Johnson is active in NAACP, author of Autobiography of a Colored Man, has a long history in other things also, and he's also in the diplomatic service. A woman named Miss Cohn, who's a librarian at the 135th Street Library. But Harrison ultimately makes his move to concentrated work in the black community after he does theater reviews, and he explains and explores the role of the black artist and black actor, you know, in the same issues that people are up against today in terms of images and projections and things. And he starts saying, we got to deal, you know, we've got some issues we want to deal with, we've got to start addressing. So he makes this turn to concentrated work in the black community. Randolph is following him in this period, Owen. And Harrison starts articulating the notion that what we have to do is build unity from the bottom up. And he says, the fault with the previous unifiers, if you will, was that they've gone about it from the wrong end. They started at the top, not at the bottom. Du Bois with the talented tent, Booker T with his powerful machine coming down. And he goes, to attempt to unite the intellectuals at the top was not the same as uniting the Negro masses, the key to racial solidarity. Because you got to light the fire at the bottom. Interestingly, in 1940, in his third autobiography, Du Bois comes around to this conclusion, right? But again, if Harrison was, you know, discussed and heeded more, there might have been some more movement on this. 1617, he starts lecturing on the birth of the new Negro movement. He's talking about race consciousness and internationalism. It's mass-based, geared towards the common people, political equality, social justice, defense of family. It's a proactive policy. They're not going to wait for whites. They're going to dictate, you know, and determine their own course. Richard B. Moore is following Harrison in his period. Here's a leaflet from the first meeting of Harrison's Liberty League. June 12, 1917, outside Bethel AME Church, had a progressive minister. Harrison was not totally opposed to working with the church, right? On 132nd Street. And if you can see the slogan on the flyer, Wilson led the U.S. into war to make the world safer for democracy. Here's Harrison, let's make the South safe for democracy, right? That's his response to Wilson. And the speakers, you might not be able to see it here, but I will tell you, Hubert Harrison first, then Chandler Owen, socialist, then Adam Clayton Powell, senior, the father of Adam Clayton Powell. And then at this rally, Harrison invites Marcus Garvey up to the stage, Garvey's first major talk before a Harlem crowd. Liberty League focuses on democracy and equality. It's opposed to segregation, lynching, and disfranchisement. Advocates enforcement 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. Federal anti-lynching legislation. I'm coming back to this. This is crucial. Argues for a political voice. Voice was the name of his paper. He quotes from Woodrow Wilson about the need for a voice. And they engage in efforts to get the first black elected officials in New York, because there had been none. And constantly talking about militant armed self-defense. He will do it in 1917, around the time of the East St. Louis riot, which I'll get to in a second. But he's doing it even before the riot. This is 17 is 44 years before Robert F. Williams, people may be more familiar with later on. He is advocating armed self-defense. When the Klan rises in Jersey, he comes out and challenges the Klan in Jersey. Tulsa, someone was talking about, there was just a movie on Tulsa the other night. In Tulsa, he's writing things about the need for armed self-defense in 1919 during all those race riots. So he's very militant on these issues. But federal anti-lynching legislation, I want to go back to this for a second, because Harrison is a big proponent of federal anti-lynching legislation, as is Boston's William Monroe Trotter. Why is federal anti-lynching legislation important? Because we got about 10 more minutes, so if you can hold on, we'll make it. Federal anti-lynching legislation, with federal anti-lynching legislation, you have a chance to get some justice. Without it, you get the Emmett Till type situation where the culprits walk into the courtroom and just yoke, and they know nothing's going to happen to them, right? So Harrison and Trotter want to push for it. But what most people don't know, NAACP, people associate with anti-lynching work, but for its first decade plus, it refused to support federal anti-lynching legislation. And why? For the exact same reason that Harrison had warned. It was reaching for Southern white support. They didn't want to alienate whites. And Harrison had articulated this earlier. There's a fellow named Charles Flint Kellogg writes A History of the NAACP, Volume 1, which talks about this, right? It talks about another thing I'm going to get to in a second. And it's very good. It's very probing, good work. And it was supposed to be Volume 1. Volume 2 is supposed to come. But after he wrote so many unsavory truths about what really went on, they never commissioned Volume 2, so they never got to publish Volume 2. But so Harrison's pushing for federal anti-lynching legislation, armed self-defense. Marcus Garvey joins Harrison's Liberty League. If anybody knows anything about Marcus Garvey, he's not someone to join anyone else's organization. Here's East St. Louis, 1917, which I talked about. I talk about in both books. In East St. Louis, World War I is on. Black workers coming up from the South to work in war industry in East St. Louis. Samuel Gompers and a fellow named Carter, president of the Railroad Brotherhoods, start putting all these inflammatory things, make all these comments and in the press about black work, Negro workers taking white men's jobs, you know, things like that. Leads to a vicious series of race riots over a number of days in East St. Louis. And in this, and that's Harrison, again, articulating the need for self-defense and everything like that, and very critical of these labor leaders doing this, right? And in this particular picture, there's a black man in front of a streetcar surrounded and being attacked by a mob of whites while the National Guard stand around doing absolutely nothing, right, in this picture. Harrison continually stresses the international duty. He's got always that international aspect with the Liberty League and the work. This is very interesting. Please pay attention. Harrison develops a tricolor flag for his Liberty League. The colors are black, brown, and yellow. He gives two reasons. He says that's the colors we are domestically, and that's the colors we are internationally, kind of like a third world concept. Right? From the black, brown, and yellow, and I'm sorry about this rendition. It's my PowerPoint. That's okay. But black, brown, and yellow. From the black, brown, and yellow, Garvey switches to red, black, and green. And Harrison offers his comments on that, and I leave you to read them in the book, right? Last chapter of first volume, last 2 or 3 minutes. Boston's William Monroe Trotter. Like Harrison, wants federal anti-lynching legislation. Like Harrison, is critical of what's going on, you know, all over. So they decide to convene a National Liberty Congress in Washington, D.C. And they do convene it. And here's the picture from the front, that the front cover of the book is taken from. There's Harrison, there's Trotter. If you can see in this picture, but I will describe it. It's men and women from 35 states. And they come together in Washington, D.C. in early July 1918 to push for enforcement, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, demand federal anti-lynching legislation, push forward the amendment. It is the major black protest effort during World War I. Now, a couple of things have happened. First, right prior to this, as the war starts to develop, one of the big issues in the black community was the issue of segregated officers' training camps, right? Because the military was segregated. And the black press was all over that issue. And they're saying, well, if you want people to go sacrifice and die in war and stuff like that, we have to have integrated camps. You know, that's a just demand. Randolph would raise the same issue during World War II. According to Kellogg, that book I mentioned, the black community was on the verge of winning integrated officers' training camps when Joel E. Spingarn, who's European-American, if you're not familiar, I'm going to get into him in a second, but he's the head of the NAACP. NAACP did not have a black national head for its first 10 years plus. Spingarn speaks up on behalf of the black community as his, you know, at the head of the NAACP and says, we will accept the segregated camps, right? Harrison shocked, right? The second big issue that comes up in this respect in, during the war is the Liberty Congress. And here we go. So Harrison and Trotter are going to hold and do hold this Liberty Congress, this protest effort. This is Joel Spingarn. He's the head of the NAACP, Romance Language Professor at Columbia University. He is a pro-war socialist. Lenin says during World War I, the dividing line in the international communist movement is between the pro-war and the anti-war socialist. He's pro-war, right? He's the head of the NAACP. He is also a major in military intelligence. Here he is in his military uniform. Military intelligence was that branch of the intelligence community that monitors the black and the radical community. It is in many ways like being in COINTELPRO 55 years later, right? He is also a couple of other things. Please remember as what I'm going to tell you now. To this day, the NAACP gives their award for outstanding achievement by a black American in his name. It's called the Spingarn Medal. Brathwaite, who I mentioned earlier, was the first recipient, right? Mm-hmm. Spingarn is also, by Du Bois's own admission, Du Bois's closest white friend, right? So what happens is the following. Once Spingarn gets wind of this Liberty Congress, he doesn't want to have that at all, so he tries to get word to Trotter to call it off. No way, Trotter's not calling. He doesn't even try on Harrison, right? So he falls back to Plan B. Okay, we've got to undercut this. So they decide to hold a, quote, colored editors conference to meet a week before the Liberty Congress in Washington, D.C. Now, a certain thing about this colored editors conference. One, it's all male, unlike the Liberty Congress, which is male and female. Two, it's not an all-black affair, as is the Liberty Congress, right? There are certain European Americans, certain white people involved, including FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, people we're familiar with later. In this period, he's Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and one of his main claims to fame is he personally did so much in writing the Constitution of Occupied Haiti, right? A constitution which still stuck with people for so many years. That's as he's coming along the way, right? And so they hold that conference, and they try and steal some thunder, and they put out some pronouncements. But there's more to the story than that. Spingarn tries to involve Du Bois in the effort, and Du Bois gets involved in the effort. Du Bois takes part in the Colored Editors Conference. But Du Bois does a bit more. He does more. Spingarn talks to Du Bois and suggests he also put in an application for a captaincy in military intelligence. And Du Bois does. I mean, it's Du Bois' decision, right? But again, that's the branch of the government that monitors the black and the radical community. Booker T. Washington had died a year and a half earlier or some such, right? Everyone is looking to Du Bois as the paramount black leader. Or basically, he's considered that, right? Yeah. And Du Bois puts in an application for a captaincy in military intelligence. This is the period, and what I'm going to tell you is what he's probably most embarrassed about in his own life. He writes three autobiographies, doesn't really want to talk about this. It's not discussed. But in order to get the captaincy, to seal the deal, the quid pro quo, if you will, he does the following. He writes an editorial in July 1918, Crisis Magazine, called Close Ranks. It is one paragraph long. He writes, "Let us, while this war lasts, forget our special grievances." And he goes on to basically to say close ranks behind the war bit. What are the special grievances? He had defined them 2 months early in the crisis. Everybody knew what they were. Lynching, segregation, and disfranchisement. Harrison responds in his paper, Du Bois, and writes an editorial, The Dissent of Dr. Du Bois. And in that editorial, basically what Harrison's arguing, look, we can differ on the war, you know. Not that, you know, he's going to necessarily agree with your position, but you don't have to go there. You don't have to take it there. You're a prominent black leader. Forget our special grievances. And then he also ties it in to Du Bois putting in the application for the captaincy, which people didn't know. People didn't know about it. And Du Bois is really discredited in large circles. All the younger generation of militants, the Briggs, the Moore, they're all following Harrison's lead. Harrison is, in some ways, at a high point of his national leadership. He's ready to start taking his militant program into the South in 1918. This is when we end Volume 1, because I want to leave Volume 2. And so in the summer of 1918, we have Harlem is considered the center of radical black thought. Harrison's considered the leading voice of Harlem radicalism. He's only 35, brilliant orator, writer, thinker. He had led in challenging capitalism and white supremacy, leading black activists and theoreticians of the Socialist Party, founded the New Negro Movement, major black protest leader in wartime America. His class and race conscious message influenced a generation of activists and common people and will continue to influence, right? He laid out broad parameters that would shape and influence much black radical thought for the remainder of the 20th century, whether people knew it or not, right? And he left an important legacy for the 21st century. Hubert Harrison, there we are, and that's where you can get more information on it. Thank you.